Welcome to Real Estate Radio Live, an informative and engaging podcast discussing everything you need to know about the world of real estate. Your host, Joe Cacera, provides you with insight and guidance on how to buy, sell, finance, and invest in real estate. He also offers real estate tax management strategies, new construction advice, home improvement tips, and much, much more. And now, to guide you around the world of real estate, here's your host and Real Estate Radio Live team leader, Joe Cacera.
Welcome in, Joe Cacera with Real Estate Radio Live. Thank you for those that are continuing to follow us on Facebook. We appreciate that. We want to continue to grow the audience in any way we can. However, this is a podcast, even though we love the people that watch us on social media. So be sure, if you're watching us or if you haven't done so yet, please download the podcast. You could do that by going to iTunes. Just type in Real Estate Radio Live. You can go to Stitcher, Google Plus, anywhere on the internet. You could find Real Estate Radio Live. Just type it in and download the podcast. Follow us if you may, and also pass it along to friends, family, and coworkers as well. Before we get started, again, most of you, if you've just joined us and haven't been following the show, the focus is education and information. That's why I started the show 8 years ago, radio and now podcasting, to deliver as much information and education to you, the consumer, so that you can make wise decisions in and around your real estate. So what we've done is expanded. We've done some new series. Last year, most of you following the show, you know Jack Russo and I. Jack's here again today.
Hi, Joe. It's good seeing you in the flesh. Are you well? I had to sub in for you.
I'm well.
Good. You look great. Your spring training has started, right?
I'm feeling better.
You must be getting excited about
baseball. I was afraid
baseball.
We might have to do the next one from the hospital bed, but I'm okay now.
Makes you appreciate your health, doesn't it?
It does. It does for sure. So I'm back. Last year, Jack and I started the series Starting Something New, really about, you know, from square one, starting a business, all the things to be involved with that, A to Z. This year, we kicked off growing your business. So we're going to have a series of guests on a regular basis when we can as well. So we'll get started. Jack, you want to take it from here and introduce our guest?
Right.
And,
this is the way, yeah, let me just say, this is the way Silicon Valley works, which is you represent various clients, and they inevitably refer people that they think you can help. And I had on the show last week Dr. Sam Savage, and Dr. Savage said, hey, you know, you really need to meet Martha, because Martha, am I pronouncing
it
right?
I'm Ram.
Yeah. Martha is a super smart person, and she's doing something that's unique because she's been successful in academia, and now she's made her way into business, and she's growing a business, so fit right in the growth model.
Right.
In a way that leverages an existing business where she learned a lot about what works as well as what doesn't work. So I invited Martha on the show. She's very busy. You're in fundraising mode for your company right now.
Indeed.
Right?
But I think every person in growth mode is always fundraising.
You got it. I mean, it's a little bit like today. I met a guy that was introduced to me through a common friend, Andrew, who was on the show. I listened to the show. I loved it. And Andrew said, this guy is going to be amazingly successful, but he doesn't realize just how smart he is. And he doesn't realize that he needs to think in a bigger way than just, will I make it to become executive VP from director of whatever. And I saw like the talent like you are in starting a company. So tell us about the journey from academia to business first, because just to get some background, you have a PhD from Stanford or Yale?
No, from MIT.
MIT, it's even better.
Which is really important.
That's big. That's huge, right? That alone gets you funded, doesn't it?
No. No.
We do like to put a little levity in these things.
So after graduating from MIT, I taught at Boston University for like 7 years. And so then I landed in the Valley, having left BU.
Yes.
And also coming to the Valley, my whole family moved
out. That's why I thought you were from the East Coast, because you went to school there, which is like a six-year hitch, or what is it like?
Five and a half for me at
MIT.
MIT,
right? Yeah. Which is short, probably, because there probably are some PhDs there that, ninth year, the dissertation's not written yet, right? It's What was the study? What were you focusing on at MIT?
So I, one of the early graduates in applied economics.
Yeah,
MIT has the best economics department in the country, but I always was like itching to make it work. So in the Sloan School, the business school of MIT, they had a department called Applied Economics. And you may all remember like options tradings on the financial markets growing, and then employee stock options here in the Valley.
Yes.
Two steps back is a mathematical model called the Black-Scholes equation. Fisher-Black, Myron-Scholes, here at Stanford,
I remember,
and Bob Merton.
Yes.
All three of them have MIT connections, and they invented this equation that allowed markets to open up around trading options and other derivatives.
Right.
And I was at MIT when that was
great. And that's all based on the work of Fama or some of these very famous guys I studied in business school years ago. The names are coming up.
Yeah.
But conceptually, when you think about the decision to just go into that area, did you think you were becoming an academic, or did you think, no, I'm going to do like what they do, because they started a business that then failed, that big hedge fund that blew
long-term
up.
Capital.
Right, long-term capital.
But they were all in their safety nets of being academics.
That's right. That's
no,
right.
I am the child of a professor.
Of course, I
was going to be a professor.
There you go.
But what I found out at Boston University was I have kind of a itchy foot. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to study legal messes or derivatives from yesterday. I wanted to be part of today and the future.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was great to land here in the Valley. One of my first consulting assignments was at National Semiconductor.
Okay.
And they said, you're not from Stanford, you're not in the club.
Really?
So I just wanted to point that out, that the MIT degree at that time did not carry weight.
How long ago was that?
96.
They wouldn't do that now, right?
No, I don't think so. MIT's got a great reputation.
Yeah, they do. Right.
And I didn't realize that the economics department was, as I think of the engineering school, and I think of, you know, sort of the techie part, but you're saying the engineering, the economics department has this great grandeur to it.
Yeah, so you know George Shultz, who's here from the Valley.
Yep.
He was one of the first doctoral students in the economics department at MIT.
Okay.
He went there to work with Paul Samuelson, who at that point was probably a 28-year-old whippersnapper. And Paul was at MIT because he was a graduate student at Harvard, and they wouldn't hire him because of anti-Semitism. MIT got formed with Samuelson and a few others who wouldn't be hired elsewhere, but then just shot to the top of the rankings, and we don't think like that anymore. But the department has a deep rigor around getting it right, facing your data, looking it squarely in the eye, and giving the tools to be intellectually honest. And I so appreciate that, going deep until you know it in your cellular DNA, because now I'm doing something really different, but I know it when I know it.
So,
you know?
so real world counts for a lot in MIT.
Always has.
As opposed to more the theoretical, maybe Harvard kind of hoity-toity.
Their motto is mind enhanced. That is the MIT motto. And it is always about making it work. So just as one example, MIT has put every course they teach online.
I saw that.
Anybody can take it.
Yes.
So they have great stories about so-and-so and literally Timbuktu started taking their classes and then got admitted to MIT.
Wow.
Or a student from a community college, their chemistry professor in a community college said, you're really good. Why don't you take that course online in chemistry?
Right.
And that person got admitted straight from community college to MIT.
Wow. So was there a day when you woke up in your teaching at Boston University, I'm done, I'm over the academic thing, I'm graded the last paper I'm ever going to grade, thank you very much, I'm headed west and I'll find opportunity there? How did it happen?
So you're looking at me with a smile on my face, but it is no secret I was denied tenure at BU.
Ah, okay.
And
That hurts.
It really hurt, and I learned a lot from the experience and got a job offer from Harvard Business School. So, you know, karma reached out.
Yeah, there you go.
Wow, so that's a nice little move.
But I didn't go there.
You know,
I just didn't want to be a professor anymore.
Huh.
But my point being that you come to different points in your life, you go through those things, and you get to box them back into perspective.
Yes.
And so the decision was made for me, and I think in retrospect, as I moved out of academia, I was like, oh, my God, I have this motion sense that made me not the best academic, but better in other things.
So it was like a door opening.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Many people take failure as sort of the end, but many people are amazed that, gosh, it just made me realize, you know, there's so many other things to do. I mean, there's so many examples. I can give many examples of that where people just get up and say, hey, man, this is a blessing in disguise. And I imagine you at some point said, hey, I'm going to head west. Or what led you west? How'd you get to Silicon Valley?
My husband had started a company in the Boston area and then wanted to start a second one. And it was just a more fruitful environment out here. So we moved, and I had done some legal work in between those two periods. So I was able to stay with the same litigation support.
Oh, as an expert witness, right?
Yes.
Because you did expert witness.
Because I've been on derivatives cases and valuation matters. And that's why I know what Jack's talking about sometimes.
Okay. So that's beautiful. So when did the idea occur, hey, I've got a great idea for something that really can be changing in artificial intelligence, because that's your current business, right?
Mention that.
What's the current business? You're the founder and CEO of the current business, right?
Yeah, both of them. But first we started a company, and the story there is I am a senior fellow at the Milken Institute.
Okay.
And Mike Milken and John Bonds.
Yep. It's great, yep. An ex-felon who gives a bunch of money. I mean, no, seriously, there's a guy that just came off of disaster and turned it around,
yeah,
right?
Sure did.
Exactly.
I mean,
and every guy out there owes a thanks to say, Mike, thank you for funding prostate cancer research.
Yes,
that's
right.
You changed the game on that one.
Yes, exactly.
But the Milken Institute is about slicing and dicing risk and financial market know-how and bringing it to some of the bigger problems.
Right.
And the big problem was greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm.
So I wrote
Still is.
Yeah, I wrote a white paper for them that said, you know, there needs to be somebody in the middle between the utilities and the consumers. And I was like, well, why not me? And that's when we formed the energy business.
Okay.
In the energy business, we have years of experience of engaging consumers and what works and doesn't.
Right.
We had to shift our business model a couple times, and we ended up being the industry's best platform for, if you're like getting solar from SunPower, they can look with satellite on your roof. And they can figure out how much solar panels you can hold.
Right.
Now they need to look at the energy use inside. We are that company.
Okay, so we're
connect bills to houses.
So I've done this little exercise because I get these promotions all the time, and they come in, and I always think it's amazing. And of course, my wife says, "You're crazy. You're wasting your time. It doesn't pencil." She has a PhD from Stanford. You'll like meeting her, but she says, nah, stop wasting time. But I type in all the data, and then it says, let us have access to your PG&E bill.
Yeah.
And that data gets piped. And are you the pipe?
We are the pipe.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and the crux of the matter is you can bring it over. Now you got to read the bill.
Yes, now what?
So the traditional method is what I would call arts and crafts engineering.
Yes.
Engineer who likes to code now has to become expert on utility bill reading, which is hieroglyphics and most of us.
Right.
It didn't work. And so we needed a more scalable method because I built a national platform. We connect over to like 400 utilities, gas and electric.
Really?
So that's a lot of engineering, right? So like, no, we're going to go into some more automation.
Yes.
And I would like to thank my co-founder, Sandra Carrico, another woman, VP of engineering and chief data scientist. And she said, well, let's give a little machine learning a try.
Yes.
And got better and better. So now we read utility bills automatically, and we can do it at scale, and we're 98% accurate out of the box with no human intervention.
Probably good enough, right, for this analysis?
No.
It's not good enough for solar? It's not?
So for the person that explain how those are read. For the person that's listening to this show, they might think, well, how is that read, and how is that determined, and how does that decipher? Explain a little bit how that works.
That's the secret sauce, but
So inside the world of artificial intelligence, which is like, can machines do things that we want to get done, the object here is to take the total amount due and those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know those numbers, and I want to put them in a database.
Okay.
So I'm trying to get them out of the bill. What's going on is a subsection of artificial intelligence called machine learning, which gives you a sense of, computers, makes prediction models. And it's you set up a training set where it knows the answer. It knows that this one's $102, one's $104.
Okay.
You give it a training set, and then it eats it up bit by bit and learns.
Mm-hmm.
And then you give it a fresh set, and it's making a prediction that it got that answer right. And each data answer is scored 0 to 100.
Mm.
And so you can be confident or not confident about pulling out the exact right number.
Got it.
So when I say we come in at 98% accuracy, that's comparing a printed bill against what we pulled out. And in our machine learning system, we only pull out numbers that we're highly confident on.
Hmm.
And we don't mess it up with bad data. We just leave those empty.
Right.
And that's all automated now, or there still is some human intermediary in that?
No, when I talk about 98, that's why I made that point to say straight through processing.
Yes. Yes.
So you might have used a receipt automation service called Expensify, or heard about it?
Yes.
There's plenty of stories on the internet that they said they were doing this, but actually they were sending your receipts to India. And so there's a hidden secret that in artificial intelligence, it takes a long time to build up the training data set.
Oh, like Theranos, right?
Yeah.
Sending it off to be analyzed by hand? Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so there's probably...
You mentioned Schultz, so I have to get Theranos in because he was on the board or on the advisors or one of
the
investors,
on the board.
Right?
Yeah, but there's probably 50, 60,000 people in India doing the keystrokes.
That entry,
To set up data models that may turn into artificial intelligence later, but meanwhile are doing this manual labor to get it all set up. We don't do that.
With all this AI and this excitement of new technology, what you're working on now, Is there still some sort of resistance from traditional legacy industries that have a hard time grabbing onto this? Or is everybody adopting to it now and embracing it?
So a little of both.
Okay.
And what we're seeing is there are companies that will give you a set of tools. Mm-hmm. So if you have data scientists on your staff, here's tools they can use. Often the first data scientists or the second are right in the corner of your office near mm-hmm. the potted plants. And that's what I call them. Like, if you have data scientists that are over by potted plants, you're not ready for
them. Just walk by and water them every once in a while.
And then I had a really great talk with a guy who's in the data science team at Uber, and that's a pretty leading edge. So they have 4 teams, 80 each.
Wow.
One does supply matches demand. One does fraud detection. And then teams 3 and 4 are doing testing, like, does blue work better than green on the app? You know, project-based before and after type analyses. And the problem that you have in managing a big team like that is, what is the underpinning of software tools?
Mm. Right.
They keep it honest and on track, and you can keep learning. So the industry's been building out that undercurrent of software tools.
Mm. Right.
So we got tools to give to people, we got software tools, and then our company is the third generation, which is, frankly, all I do with our new product is, like utility bills, we do invoices, we do medical documents, we take that data that's printed and we put it in a database.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really care how I do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's AI inside, it's AI as a service.
So you learned kind of the hard way that the energy space seemed ripe for the solution. You made the solution happen. You still run that business, right? What is the name of that business?
It's called Watson.
Like W-A-T-T-Z-O-N.
Yeah.
And it's a business-to-consumer way to assist doing the calculations that have to be done about what's your energy spend versus what will solar deliver. That industry has been hit really hard, which must have affected you.
Yes, and as I mentioned before we started the show, it's known as the solar coaster.
Right.
So why does it go up and down?
Yeah.
Credit markets, you know, they can freeze, and almost all the solar companies almost died in the Great Recession.
Right.
But still, interest rate fluctuations and credit issues can affect that industry. The cost of selling to consumers still chews up quite a bit of money in that business, maybe 40% of all cost in solar. And the margins are very thin in energy because solar and other new technologies have to fit into what is essentially a commoditized energy market that's on a lucky day getting 4% net income, right?
Yes.
So we always thought we could be that digital play that surfs a wave of roller coaster and margins.
Right.
There's no room for that in that industry. And I think most of Sand Hill Road knows that as well, that they've tried to figure out how to invest in clean tech and how to find the scalable path.
Right.
Very few have made money.
So
very few.
This is the point I wanted to make in a question form. You one day realized this target domain is not going to produce the billion-dollar company, but we've learned a lot about doing this AI solution that we can now extend and apply in a new domain, and that's the new company, which is really part of the same company, but kind of the outbirth of the technology. What's the name that you're using for that?
We call it Glint, G-L-Y-N-T dot A-I.
Okay.
Glint dot A-I has its own website.
Yes.
And I wish I could be smart and say, and we saw the future. But actually the future knocked on our door.
Okay.
And so being here in Silicon Valley, you collide, right?
Okay.
So, and the first call was from something that's equally disruptive, which is, can consumers be in charge of their medical data?
Okay.
How do you get in charge of your medical data? Well, you have those scraps of paper from CVS, from the lab reports, from the doctor's office.
Right.
They're all lost.
Yes.
They're not part of your medical record.
Right.
Could our data extraction from documents help consumers get those online?
Oh, that's a big area, right?
Yes.
That's huge.
So we got those calls. We started having those conversations. We saw the light. Then we started getting calls from big accounting firms who have a lot of invoices to process when they do audits.
Yeah.
It's like a $75 billion industry.
It's huge.
Who knew?
Really? Right.
So the industries are coming towards us, and that's why we formed the Glint website. I have to say IRS, investment banking, and utility bills all are toxic to cocktail conversations.
Yes.
And so the faster we stop saying, well, we do utility bills, the better.
Oh,
and so we got over to Glint.
Yes.
I never say utility bills over there.
But Glint is like a take on Gleam or you know, Extract, but using kind of your own made-up name, which is good. And you got the .ai, which is great. So I'm just dying to ask this question because you're really smart, you have a lot of energy, and Google is paying like $1 million if you're willing to go work for them as a data scientist. Yeah. So how do you stay motivated? It's not just Google, it's Microsoft, yeah. Uber, all these players would love you to lead an AI group, and here you are doing your own startup,
right.
And obviously out there raising money and probably not taking much of a salary and all that jazz. How do you resist the headhunter who calls you daily? You know, you're right, the exact profile. We looked at your online profile. You must get these calls all the time. Well, and your team, too, right?
Oh, my team especially. Yes. You have to remember, every time I say we, there's a royal we. I don't code.
Yes.
You know,
no
I look at spreadsheets.
Yes. Yeah,
I say, guys, put it in spreadsheet form, please.
Yes.
But I am a data geek, and over the last 2 years, I have totally seen the business of AI and learned how to position it. So I do bring business value. Look, Sandra Carrico, who developed our very important form of machine learning, she's probably a $5 million hire.
Yes.
I totally see that.
Yes.
And we have a team that stuck together over 2.5 years, and as you point out, we took reduced salaries.
Yes.
When I go raise money, people go like, are you kidding me?
Yes.
You guys hung together in the heart of Silicon Valley?
Right.
So I would
say...
How did you do that?
Let's talk about that for a minute. How did you keep them so loyal? I mean, that's so great because the loyalty is at a...
Especially around here.
Around here?
Yeah.
You know, there's a 25% churn, I was told today, in,
I believe
in people sort of leaving. Mm-hmm. And the average is like 28 months or something. They leave after 28 or 30 months.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is, I guess, there aren't any long-term pension plans or anything like that anymore. It's all about stock options and investing.
Or they're looking for the next best thing.
The next thing. Right?
Yeah.
Next thing.
I actually think it's a different story.
Yes.
Like, if this is Silicon Valley is the epitome of a global labor market.
Yes.
People come here because they want to be here.
Yes.
And particularly they'll go to Google or some of these bigger places, LinkedIn.
Yes.
That's a safety net. And
yes.
then they get an idea,
they
go out and do a startup.
Right.
Frankly, if it fails, the safety net's still there.
Okay.
So good point.
It's an option to try out your dreams.
Yes.
This is a valley, still the valley of dreams.
Yes.
And for my team, you know, I hope nobody on the team would hate me for this, but we're all in our 40s, 50s, and so on. And we don't like drama.
You're safe here.
We like to work together.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we saw that we could pull this off if we just hunkered down. And I don't think it was that easy.
Okay.
And I don't think the team thinks it went that quick.
Okay.
But we are in general availability. We have customers coming in the door.
Right.
And life feels very different than it did a year ago.
And what you cracked, which I think is the real innovation here, is you don't need lots of cycles to get the machine learning to work, right? It's like 7 or 8 cycles. Explain what you've done, which really makes a big diff.
So here's a story for you. Last March, I was trying to figure out, well, are we really good at this, or how good at machine learning are we? You know, because you never really know since I don't code, right? So I took some of our team to visit some faculty at MIT, since I am an MIT alum. And we found out that there's two ways to think about artificial intelligence in the U.S. Here in the Valley, we have Google and Facebook, and they have what we might call data exhaust. We all interact with them, and we generate a crap load of data.
Yeah, and they love storing it and keeping it and using it.
Yeah,
right?
And so that they can be kind of using models that need they're hungry for data, and there's plenty to do it. So the norm in the Silicon Valley is to do AI with lots of data, and without lots of data, the models won't work.
Right.
What we saw at MIT was really interesting, which is kind of small data sets being brought to life, also with AI. And we're like, wait a minute, you don't need a lot of data if you think about the problem differently. So over the next 9 months, we developed a system that's on the internet called mixed formal learning.
Hmm.
It's a mathematical model where there's a tight mathematical model of documents, and it's pre-built.
Okay.
And then we only need 7 more documents to customize it to like a utility or an invoice
or
something.
That's a tiny, tiny number.
Yes, 7 versus 20,000 to 300,000.
I mean, that's like saying we can install and have you up and running in an afternoon versus this is a 6-week to 6-month project. That's got to be music to people's ears, right?
Yes. And so going back to the growth story, we come from energy and those where our first customers are. For someone to replicate what we've done using traditional machine learning in the energy bill management space, you have to have what's known as a corpus, a library of, you know, literally 700,000 bills or something, given
huge.
The variety of problems. Well, there's only 5 companies that have that data stack.
Mm.
we can now serve everybody else in the industry,
yes.
saying, and we're doing it with his customers, could you send us 20 from PG&E
wow.
and 20
mm-hmm.
from SoCal Ed? We'll send them back to you tomorrow. They'll be trained. And then every day after this, you can just run your system.
I mean, that's a yeah. big point, because what people may not realize is the oligopolies and duopolies, like the Facebooks mm-hmm. of the world, that really kind of control a huge amount of data, they have an inside advantage from the fact they have all that data mm-hmm. based on the traditional models. You represent kind of the David who's coming in saying the rest of us can use AI
right.
and do it without having to worry about somehow buying. I don't even know how you would buy it, because it's not like it's easy.
You
can't buy
yeah.
it anymore. GDPR and other things make it almost impossible. But the duopolies and the oligopolies mm-hmm. have a lot of advantages.
Yeah.
And those
yeah.
advantages get bigger and bigger. And you may provide effectively, like the mm-hmm. big insight here, if mm-hmm. venture capitalists are listening, because really you're in fundraising mode
yeah.
at what I would call kind of the inflection point, where the funding is going to really super aid the growth, because you've cracked the code.
Yes.
And you know, that's a tricky thing for people to understand, because you know, because you've been there before, and you know you're in a good market now. So it's kind of like one of these things where the fire is lit, let's throw some gasoline on
yeah.
it. And the question really becomes, well, what's the meta message story? We're like mm-hmm. AI for the rest of the world,
mm.
which is a big world.
Yeah.
And that world wants to get into this in a big way.
And you've got this right. And it really does change the game, because many companies just have a couple hundred documents here, or, you know, 800,000
mm-hmm.
there. But we can do either one
yes.
with the same system. And mm. it's just such a fast turnaround. It does make a real difference. Today, a venture capitalist met with me that likes to invest in bootstrap startups, which mm. we would fit that.
Yes.
And I said,
yes.
okay, but why bootstrap? I want to hear it in your words.
Yes.
And it was sort of like, you've been through the war, nothing will throw you anymore. and they select
right.
on that.
Right.
Yeah.
No, and I think that's a big point about serial entrepreneurship. Joe is a serial entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I represent a lot of serial entrepreneurs. You're a serial mm-hmm. entrepreneur. It's that they know that they're going to be persistent.
Right.
And that
right.
persistence is going to make a difference.
Yeah.
And it's like that equation gets amplified
mm-hmm.
by persistence.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and, you know, that's hard to read. You have to meet people
right.
and talk to them
right.
to really understand that. I mean, you obviously see that it's going to pay off.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a bigger sort of mission, as it were. It's not just about making money. You're
mm-hmm.
really doing something that's going to help a lot of other companies potentially get into the fourth industrial revolution.
Right.
There are a lot that are still stuck, kind of like, we have to read the spreadsheet and, like, you know, get the slide rule out. Yeah, that's
yeah.
not the way the world works anymore. I mean,
no.
it really isn't.
So the irony, first of all, I give a shout out to
yeah.
my team, because
yes.
They bought into that.
Yes.
We might become a legend
yes.
if we do this.
Yes.
And we, you know,
yes.
it's working. But remember when we started Watts On, we wanted to help people reduce greenhouse gas emissions,
yeah.
save money at
mm-hmm.
home.
Yes.
By reading utility bills efficiently, we're back onto that. And it's a little bit different. Many commercial properties have energy managers.
Mm.
Those energy managers are doing spreadsheets, manual
right,
data
yeah,
entry.
Right, right.
And they say, we just can't scale. We don't have any more real estate to put office workers in.
Right.
This is ridiculous.
Right.
And so when we come in and say, no, we'll just automate this. We'll help your current workforce
right.
get the job done. And then you can put more in the box
mm-hmm.
here. You can build more revenue.
Yeah.
It's a winning combination, but it's reducing energy use
yes.
nationwide on these commercial
mm.
properties. So it's like
huge.
We're back on the game.
Yeah, it's a huge
it's
thing.
Exciting.
Yeah.
And
very
you,
good.
You, there's an argument in a way that one could argue. I don't know if this may be too mm. big of an argument, but maybe the truth is that this may save the current health care crisis, to actually have some sense of the data, because I don't think as a society, and not even in the U.S., which is pretty advanced, we have a really good sense of what people are spending
mm-hmm.
so much money and time on.
No.
That's kind of a waste. I just give a footnote here to a guy, he's 92, his birthday just came up. He's a famous guy, Len Hayflick. I had him over at Stanford. I invited him to Stanford to the medical school because
mm-hmm.
I did a little pro bono presentation there. I had him come in and he said, you know, we spend so much money on health care for so many stupid things that if you really do the analysis, it's not even adding like 3 months of
yeah.
extension
right.
to your life. And yeah, life is pretty valuable, But the amount of money that could go to people that are starving, like he just did the mega announcement. Yeah. We have a bunch of medical students there. And like, yeah, that's how we understand. We understand we're supposed to do prescriptions, and this is a course about, you know, healthy lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, you guys need to get into healthy lifestyle and not this repair Medicaid mode.
Yeah.
But I don't think we have a good sense of the data. And maybe you're going to change that. Maybe that's part of what's going to happen here.
So everything I've learned about healthcare says is exactly this problem of incomplete data.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You go into the doctor and they open up your record electronically.
Yes.
And half of the information came from your other providers via a PDF or scan or fax. None of that
go over our time limit here?
No,
no?
I don't think. No.
Okay, we're good.
We've got a few more minutes.
Yeah,
no,
sorry,
we're good.
Half of that came in through PDF scan or fax and is not available to the physician.
It's not actionable.
It's still captured inside that container of a document. And so that's half of your history, half of your data.
Yes.
And right now the National Institute of Health is trying to put together 1 million patient records so that we can have full records on 1 million people and we can build better prediction and have a healthier life. But they can't get the data together.
Mm, okay.
And so we're stumbling in the healthcare world about connections between data silos. It's called interoperability.
Sure.
Not even a single standard for that, despite CDC leadership.
Right. Starting to happen, though.
Right.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
I don't want to take too much time, but it's just, as you guys are talking about this, I did a follow-up visit to my doctor today that did a simple sinus procedure like 6 months ago. So you do follow-up, right? Well, so I'm in their office this afternoon, and the nurse that's prepping things, or his assistant, is asking me about, are you still taking this medication? And I thought, how'd you know about that? Well, it's the medication I was on for my kidney stone just 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
And I said, how'd you? Well, we
you have all the records.
That's never happened to me before.
Right. So you were like, wow, it's actually working. The system's working.
Yeah.
And do you go to Kaiser?
No, I don't.
Okay, because that Kaiser's actually pretty good at it.
Are they pretty good at it? No, I don't have Kaiser.
Yeah, shout out to them.
No, but that was just the first time I experienced it, and it caught me by surprise, and I said, how did you know all that stuff? So first it's a little weird, but then you're thinking, I guess that's good that they share that information.
But let me give you an idea that just occurred to me as we were talking. You know, part of what's happening in the world these days is everything's headed to the cloud.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the data in whatever volume that exists, Dropbox, Box, SharePoint, you can go through all these providers. They're all cloud-based. Google, obviously, big cloud-based. So what's happening to all those cloud providers is they're starting to realize that people want to do stuff with their data.
Yeah.
So the thing that occurred to me today as I was talking to some different people is they're starting to actually sort of appify the cloud services.
Mm-hmm.
So Box has something called Box Skills.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you could be a provider into Box Skills.
Oh, good point. Right,
that's like a super partnership because they have all the customers.
Right.
It's a good point.
So what they're doing, let me give you an example, and this I think is all public information. If you're a Box subscriber and you have enough audio that you want to store it in Box, they provide a Box Skill app that will go through that audio, create the text translation, and then analyze in the text translation what was the inflection point in the conversation where the emotions changed, you know, the quality of service changed. Well, that's like a capability you could do, right? You could effectively do medical data or any of the other data that's up there. You have a much faster way to get that done. I mean, Box and SharePoint and, you know, Dropbox and all these other folks should be all over you to get partnerships, right?
Thank you for that.
There's a freebie for you.
I would have two things to say. Yeah. One is it will be officially announced next week, and I have no problem saying it. We would just become an advanced technology partner with Amazon.
Oh,
Amazon Web Services.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Because that meant we went through their security, their privacy, their technical due diligence, and all good. And
good.
That will open up those partnerships.
Yes.
But your point about voice and text, and if you're a doctor and you want to read lab results, voice is your natural interface. And so there's some very good medical software companies that are taking the records and voice activating them so doctors don't have to do post-session clinical notes. They can just say, hey, he had this issue, let's get him this prescription, and it's all recorded real time.
Right.
When so much information is trapped in a lab report,
it's not
available to that voice system. So when we liberate data, it liberates it again through voice. And that's how these things all fit together again, just
very
like
good.
You're saying.
Yes, so it's a huge, like there's a huge opportunity, and the interesting challenge for the growth story is how do you get enough people selling for you to get in front of the customers because you've got the technology, you've got the team,
right.
You've proven that it works in energy, you've moved it over to arguably a much bigger, more lucrative field because so much is spent on healthcare, and now it's like, how do you get the message out there? I mean, how do you, you have to go like on TED Talk or 60 Minutes. You have to get on something really big that'll scale this, right?
So part of it is inbound demand creation, and we have someone lined up who will help us really scale that. But the other part, to your point, is you cannot be dialing for dollars with sales calls.
Right.
So we're developing these partnership ecosystems, and then we can use those partners to help sell for us. And we become a tools layer. They make money, and we make money. And so we have the business
model. But do you worry that one of them will try to bear hug you because, we got to just own you. We can't have this go to SharePoint. We can't have this go to Box. We can't have this go to Amazon.
If the price is right,
remember, we're dealing with trying to prevent the duopolies and oligopolies. You've got kind of a political mission. Not political,
but there's plenty of, just having been at a show this week, I can tell you the world is much bigger than our Silicon Valley. We often call them the FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. The world is much bigger than that, and particularly when it comes to enterprise documents and data.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it is true that AI companies get snapped up. For the right price, we could be snapped up. That's obviously a story there. But the reason they get snapped up...
That's the 2020 show. We'll have you back about the liquidity event. We'll have you back for that.
But you are fundraising, so let's talk about that.
You're looking for... venture capital, super angel, smart people to add to your advisory board. You're looking for the right people, really, not just money, but talent with money, right? That always helps. Because you have a small team, and that means you got to do the best you can with sort of outsourced help, right?
It's a
big deal.
So the Valley is rich in great resources, and there are these super angels, folks that have invested in AI maybe 50, 60 times.
Yes.
And I tell you, some of them have, it's like, I don't care if you give me a dime, I've learned so much from you.
Yes,
it's people often complain about fundraising, and I actually say, let's do it before lunch, let's eat lunch, we'll have a great conversation, and I'll learn, and then, another weekend riding the deck again, But it got better by talking to investors.
Well, and people like you, who are doing it in a much earlier phase, you could often get a sense of, I've been rejected too often, but, Airbnb tells a story of, 28 rejections before they got their first money, because people are like, who is going to want to open their house to someone from the outside?
Right.
That just isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
28, 29 times before they got their first
money. Wait, that's not enough. You got to be at bat.
Yes.
So the rule of, maybe
please.
You have a rule of thumb, but the rule of thumb is 50 meetings in 12 weeks.
Yeah.
And then you'll close. We're getting up to our 50, we're in 35.
Excellent.
So.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
But
so what do you want to share with the audience before we go? You want to let them know, obviously, if there's companies out there that are interested, people out there, investors, or people just want to know more about your company.
Yeah, terrific. So I think a great place to start is glint.ai, glint with a Y. We have a free trial.
G-L-Y-N-T.
Yes.
G-L-Y-N-T.ai.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a free trial, so anybody could start interacting with us. And if you live in a company that doesn't really want to share your documents with an unknown party, we have public data sets, things that you can play with that we've collected. And if you're in the energy space, we're at WattsOn. For investors, always happy to take that call. I'm Martha at glint.ai.
Okay, Martha. Thank you. That's great. Well, I'm Jack Russo, managing partner of Computer Law Group. Joe lets me come on and do a show every once in a while.
These are fun shows.
They're the best because the people have great energy.
Yeah, it's really
and
good.
And I love meeting serial entrepreneurs and hearing their story and helping them get to the next stage and figuring out. Sometimes it's just a combination of ideas and it's like, bang, that's it.
Yeah.
Make that introduction to whoever the guy is. Right. I know at SharePoint, but it sounds like Amazon's going to bear hug you here. we'll see.
We'll see.
But in any event, I'm at 650-327-9800, Jack at computerlaw.com, and thanks, Joe, for letting us
on.
Yeah,
great show. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
Been a great guest. Joe Cuchera at the Real Estate Radio Live. Thank you, then, for those that are tuning in. For more information, you can go to reradiolive.com. Take care. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Real Estate Radio Live. For more information on today's program, visit reradiolive.com. That's reradiolive.com. Subscribe to our podcast
Discover more at reradiolive.com.